The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I am delighted again to be able to speak to Richard Staveley of Rockwood Strategic, one of the UK's finest small and special situations investors. So welcome, Richard.
Very good to see you, Paul, again.
Yeah, well, massive congrats. I mean, I was just having a look at the share price of Rockwood Strategic of the fund, and just over the last sort of like 5 months, it seems to have gone up 35% from about £14 to just over £19. So massive congrats there. But before we sort of dig into the details of what you how you've managed to achieve that, just looking broadly sort of like at the equities, what's your sort of outlook for stocks and shares going forward, given all the relevant moving parts of sort of like, you know, interest rates and central banks tightening, the ongoing war in Ukraine and China reopening?
Yeah, well, thanks, Paul. So I think I'm not massively into forecasting. With markets, because I think it's a bit of a folly. But I think patience is important. And what I can say is that, you know, long term and medium term, UK small companies' patience will be very rewarded. They released last month the latest stats on the Numis Index. And if you take not the main Numis Index, but the bottom 1,000 stocks, the outperformance over large cap over the long term is literally 15 times since 1955. So those that sort of keep themselves, don't worry too much about the wars in the Ukraine. There's always some form of war going on. Maybe they're all slightly different. There's always something to sort of worry yourselves about. But actually, the medium longer term in UK smaller micro caps usually is very, you know, gives you positive returns. I think if we look to the current market situation, I feel a bit nervous about the start to the year. Sentiment was clearly very depressed, most notably with the Merrill Lynch survey, which goes from 0 to 100 and was at 0. So it's fair to say that people can get slightly more excited from 0, which they obviously did do. But I think monetary policy is usually the biggest driver of what the market is doing and what kind of a market we're in. And we're clearly in a still rising interest rate environment. I think some of the rally has the narrative's been that people are expecting interest rates to come down later this year. And foolish as I may be by saying it, but I'm a bit less I'd be a bit skeptical about that. I mean, just literally in the last couple of weeks running up to this interview, we've had UK grocery prices in February went up 17.1%. This weekend they announced that the rail fares were going up 5.9%, and to me, inflation is, you can't say slam dunk inflation's solved, it's coming back to our target of 2%. And I think the central banks are going to be very cautious about dropping interest rates, which would be supportive of markets to do that. And at the same time, people can't have it both ways. You can't have it, everything's all right, shallow recession, you know, not too much to worry about here, but also we'll have the interest rates down. I mean, most likely reason interest rates going down is actually the economics are, you know, and corporate performance is a lot worse than people expect. So we're pretty cautious, but as you kindly said, it won't make a huge difference to Rockwood's outcomes. You know, last year AIM was down about 33%, and the FTSE small cap was down 25%. And our NAV, our total return during the year, was plus 10.1%. And, you know, we were delighted about that. But I think the key point I want to make about it is that you know, that's a falling and difficult market, but we've made returns because of our stock picking. So I would encourage people to focus on the medium, longer term and getting their stock selection right.
Yeah, no, I mean, your alpha generation has been absolutely fabulous there. And you certainly set the bar high for yourself, I think, going forward, yeah. which is great because, yeah. You know.
We're up for the challenge, but exactly. It won't be whatever that is, plus 40% relative every year.
Well, we can always hope. But just on the small caps, what's sort of been scratching my head? When we entered the great financial crisis, we had small caps going into it the soonest. You had the biggest correction. It sort of like went down but it came out of the crisis the fastest. Now, that hasn't happened in this, obviously, instance. Is that largely because of the sort of like the interest rate? It was very, when they came out of the crisis, it was low interest rates are in 2009, whereas now it's sort of like, you know, 4-5%, et cetera. And has that been the drag on the cost of capital and the performance of small caps?
I think that is a very much the majority reason for it. Mm. So this time, the last couple of cycles, like GFC, massive stimulus, interest rates go from, they were going into the GFC, they were 4.5%, and slash to zero. And that effect on the valuation of the cash flows of long duration stocks, of which there are more in the UK small cap, was a huge tailwind for small caps. And also the stimulus that went alongside that was very supportive for taking on risk, of which generally small caps would be more risk prone than major markets. This cycle is the first time we've had for about three where the central banks aren't reaching for the kind of stimulus very, very quickly and in size. Obviously, COVID, massive, again, monetary stimulus plus fiscal stimulus. GFC, massive monetary stimulus. You have to actually go back to the kind of 90s for the early 90s for what was then a more normal cycle where at this point, they're not going to reach for the lever of monetary easing because of inflation. So I think within the, the makeup of the index coming into 21, there was a lot of growth shares, more higher proportion of growth shares in small UK small cap indices. And those have been derated to an extent. My view would be they still further derating to go on. And I think the sort of validation for that would be UK large cap, which is actually value, which actually did quite a good year last year relative to other financial markets, and indeed this year is all time highs, whereas sort of AIM and FTSE Smalls are still a decent chunk down from their previous highs. I think though in the medium term that sets up quite a good period for small cap once we've just digested some of the derating. So there's still quite a few stocks that aren't of interest to us, which were on very high ratings, have derated to what might appear attractive if you put it in the context of the last few years. But if you go back any further, it would still be very high ratings relative to history.
Yeah. Well, I would have thought actually with the cost of capital being quite high, particularly when it comes to sort of fundraising for small caps, that puts you in a great position because obviously we've had this M&A trend and you've had sort of like two companies recently taken over, Crestchick, which I guess you've probably got a big cash holding now, and you've got Seraphine as well. Can you just briefly talk about both of those businesses in terms of and then what you're going to do with, well, what you're planning to do with the cash? Because it must put you in a really strong position to benefit on the upside if in the medium term we do see a tick up in small caps.
Yeah, so we're running at about 33% look through cash now. The Crestchick money hit the account on Thursday. I was ringing them up every 10 minutes. knew it had hit the fund. So we are now cashed up. Seraphine will complete, I suspect, in the next couple of months. It looks like there's enough votes there for that to go through. The first point would be because we're not because Rockwood targets absolute returns of 15% a year, we're not in a rush to immediately make sure we're in a diversified portfolio that's not that far from the index in terms of sector structures or otherwise. So what that means is we're definitely not in a rush to deploy all the money immediately. However, because of the market constructs you've just said, our pipeline's actually pretty full. So we've actually got, I'm not going to obviously tell you, Paul, just be absolutely clear what we're going to do, because I know what you and all your listeners will do next.
I'd buy some shares.
Exactly. But so we've got about eight companies which we've finished DD on pretty much, like maybe 95%, where we're ready to act. As long as on a number.
How do you do your DD? Just for sort of like, just briefly in a nutshell.
We speak to customers, suppliers, competitors. We meet with the management. We also typically interview most of the board members, which a lot of fund managers won't get around to doing. I, as a former chartered accountant, I'm also a CFA, spend quite a lot of time going through the annual report, which many of your investors that listen will know are now nearly like 150 pages long, which is, you know, source of lots of information.
I bet you love that. I bet you love doing that.
I do love doing pages. It because so many other people don't bother. I just get quite wound up because these days the cash flow statements are usually about a page 100. And in my view, it should be page 2. Yeah, a lot of information you can get for the. We'll meet analysts, speak to advisors, and also we'll look over the internet. There's a lot of information you can get on our companies from the internet. We usually do two parts. So that's the original sort of initial due diligence. And then we have an investment advisory group at Rockwood with five very high, highly experienced investors. Christopher Mills, who often comes in here, is on that investment advisory group, but some other fund managers. And they will see my initial research paper, not finished, not the few typos, all that sort of thing. And then they'll come back and say, well, have you thought about this enough? I know a board member on that well. Do you want an introduction? Or I know one of the competitors, or I used to be invested in that. That's a terrible industry for reasons X, Y, and Z. Why do you think things have changed? And that will, we do that as part of, if we're going to take a much, much bigger position. And that's essentially what we do. What is the case is that when I ran money earlier in my career, I'd have 50, 60, 70 holdings. We have currently 15 holdings. After we've deployed this cash from Crestor, we're probably going to go up slightly, maybe about 20 holdings. But as a result of having much fewer than the average fund manager, we do get to spend a lot more time on due diligence than a lot of people do.
Mm. So just let's just push that one through. I know one company that you've recently been buying, RM Group, which is going through sort of like a restructuring. And I think it had a bit of a problem with its ERP sort of implementation. And for investors, it supplies all things sort of like IT and consumables. And also, I think, does exam software and stuff for schools and universities and stuff like that. Can you just take us through the investment thesis here? Because it must have a sort of like a sum of the parts, understand it, or I guess, from the logic.
Absolutely. So it's brilliant sum of the parts, three divisions. Current market cap's about 63 million market cap, something roughly around there. And as you're right, the finance director became the CEO about 2.5 years ago and got signed off a project that was budgeted at £17 million that would have taken the business that was net cash into debt in order to deploy an ERP, an enterprise resource planning system for all three divisions. At the same time, they decided to consolidate the warehouses for the largest division, and it's gone completely kind of out of control, the project. We haven't had a final number on it, so there still remains some quite short-term noise, I would call it. But essentially, it's likely, we think, to come out at least like 40 million rather than 17 million, which is just a huge amount of money to spend on the project. And what happened was they got intertwined because the system meant that they didn't know quite where the stock was on the warehouses. So it all sort of, it was just a real botch up. He's actually gone now, and they've announced a new CEO starting the next couple of weeks. Yeah. What is the sum of the parts thesis? Three divisions. The first division is called resources. It supplies schools. They're the market leader, and it's everything from pretty low stuff like exercise books and toilet roll through to they're the market leader in advanced teaching aids. They sell actually to 90% of the UK's nursery schools and about 50 and 60% of the country's secondary schools. And there'll be things that for the national curriculum, the kids need to help, as teaching aids, quite sophisticated, including robotic stuff to help them learn coding, that sort of thing, quite high margin. That is like a distribution business. So yeah. Massive warehouse, all automated now, the one they've just spent all the money on. I've been up there to see it. It's literally state-of-the-art Swiss machinery. No wonder it ended up costing as much as they did. But we've done that now. So we've got that in place. That business historically has done about 100 million of sales. I think this year, maybe 110 or something like that. 110, we'll find out shortly, but 110 million of sales. And historically, it's been around for many years. years makes between about 8% and 10% margins. Now this year it won't make that because of these problems, but there's enough evidence to suggest this business, when it's been run normally in a normal year, should make 8% to 10% margins. I actually believe that the plan to get it to one warehouse means that 10 might be the low point. They might be able to edge it up.
Okay.
In which case, I'd go for maybe one-time sales. Yeah. So that division's maybe worth 100 to 110 million. Around years, no tech risk, very, very simple. Remember, the market cap's 63.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's more than the whole market cap's worth, isn't it?
Exactly. The second division's called, they call it assessment. And that has a number of contracts, many of which they've had for well over a decade, where they do e-marking and marking of exams. They have the contracts, for instance, for the International Baccalaureate exams. They have it for the ACA, Chartered Accountancy exams. And they do Cambridge Assessment, which does actually got my daughter's one of her GCSE certificates the other day, and one of them was Cambridge Assessment. That's good.
Oh, okay.
Well, so I know that been... before. Maybe she could have got a bit. She actually got a very good mark anyway.
I guess actually the software needs to be quite sophisticated to sort of like stop the plagiarism from a ChatGPT nowadays.
You have to have good tech, and tech's becoming more important. You also need to have super trust from these bodies it's a very serious thing that can't go wrong. It was obviously scrambled by COVID. So it's come out of quite a difficult period, but again, it's been around for some time, and that business has made 15 to 20% margins.
What's the turnover on it?
Well, turnover this year is probably going to be like 35, 36.
Okay,
something
so
like
it's
that.
Quite
but
big
I suspect
then.
It's been growing because, as we know, with our wonderful education overall, I know everyone complains, but actually it's pretty good relative to the rest of the world. International bodies are appointing RM to mark their often sort of former, Commonwealth companies and countries and things. So it's growing overseas. And I think sales get to 40 million pretty soon. Now, conservatively, I've said I'll put that on 1.5x sales. But I have been in some of our due diligence, a number of people think we could get at least 2x sales for that. But let's just use
60
million for that, which is the current market cap. And then the third division they call technology. This division, I'm not a big fan of. It has been a bit of a mix. As I said, the company's been around a number of years, so it's got a few sort of things they got distracted into or tried to set up over the years. But its core activity is outsourcing the tech departments for schools. Now, they have a thesis which we validated, which is that as LEA control sort of goes down, these schools are getting into sort of trusts of, on average, about 6 to 7 schools.
Yes.
That's quite an interesting market. So you win 6 or 7 schools, you do it. It's fine. It's an okay business. If you win them, you get quite
is this
a lot
first line support? Is it help desk and stuff like that?
Full running, you'll do the broadband, do the tech, some hardware, and run. That business, they haven't been making, it's been quite low levels of profitabilities. Well-run ones in other companies make about 10% margin. I'm nervous about the competitive situation in that space.
The outsourcers, BPOs.
But it's got sort of sales of about 60 odd. Now, what they did find, which was quite fantastic from when we were buying it, so we bought the stake mainly at an average price of 30p. It's now in October or something. It's now 60p.
Yeah.
But when we were buying it, the people were seriously worried about the debt. Since then, they actually found that division had a large inventory of IP addresses. For connections, and they essentially sold off a load of those and accelerated the reduction in the of the debt and reduced some of the risk there. We think, to pull it together, but we think that this business has been undervalued by the stock market for many years, actually. It's always been seen as kind of quite slow growth. It's in the tech sector, but it's not very techy, not that techy. So it's never really had a high rating. It's been seen as quite a low growth. And as a result, eyeballs haven't really been on it. We think now there's a great opportunity here to stabilize the business with a new management team. There'll be they've got an interim finance director who's very, very good, but we'll see who gets appointed. The new CEO, I think, is potentially outstanding. He starts shortly, but we've already met him.
Yeah.
And we think that there's a great opportunity to stabilize the business and then in an orderly fashion, realize value for the three divisions. We're not in a rush at Rockwood, as you know. So, if it takes a good 3 years to sort that out, 3-4 years, then that's great, because as you worked out, that adds up to about 180, 190 million. The final division we put us at about maybe 40 million pounds, something like that. It will have the debt paid down, but normally in a normal year, it's very cash generative. I mean, even after all of this, the current EBITDA forecast is something like 18 million pounds. I mean, it's not, they'll have exceptionals and things, but it's actually the core business has always generated quite a lot of cash. So we think that will drive us. We've got a target valuation of about 170 million for it. Lots of upside
Well, 170 million with 85 million shares. That's £2 a share, even by my maths.
Yeah, and we've got about 8% of the fund in it. So we think that'll be a big driver of returns over the next 2 to 3 years.
It does seem as though there's a good sort of like restructuring thesis, and with a bit of Staveley sort of like, magic dust on it over that period. Okay, just moving now, different sectors, consumer, City Pub Group. Now, this would be something I wouldn't have expected Rockwood to be in there, given the outlook for consumer spend. But I know just from pubs around here, they've had a good sort of January, but I think February quietened off a bit.
Yeah, so what Rockwood's really looking for is for undervaluation relative to future free cash flow generation or assets. And this business, City Pub Group, is run by a guy called Clive Watson, who is a proven operator and proven creator of value. So he ran another company called Capital Pub Group, which he built up over a number of years very successfully and then sold to Greene King. When he came back to the market it's probably nearly four or five years ago. There was a lot of love, as it were, multiple times oversubscribed the IPO with a view of being a kind of growth pub company, adding loads of pubs. Now, that whole thesis, and indeed a number of the investors that invest in that company, have had a pretty tricky time after the first good couple of years where he got going, built up a decent estate. COVID. Now, energy costs for them, national living wage costs for them, food costs for them, and consumer end squeeze. However, he has built an estate of about 44 pubs. Now, they had that valued relatively recently, to be clear, it was about two-thirds, maybe 80% of the estate. Hassle doing everything. And the valuation came up with the directors of 150 million for that company. So the current market cap is 87. We bought a bit lower down, but 150 million. Now, that may actually prove conservative because if it was acquired by another group, they often will get rid of a lot of the PLC and the central costs and all the rest of it. And the EBITDA per pub is actually quite high. It's a very high quality estate. They've got some fantastic locations more affluent areas. I kind of joked with the CEO about it appears to be sort of opening up in particular constituencies of a particular party, but I think that was just by accident.
I can guess what you're saying anyway.
But as a result, they actually make, so it's a high margin. So JD Weatherspoon's margins are literally on their knees. Now, they will have, they have had depressed margins as a result of COVID and these matters, but coming out of that, they'll be making back up to, we would say, mid-teens margins relatively quickly. Right, okay. Now, two other things that's really, really important about this thesis here is it's also a lot of the other pub groups or leisure groups are highly leveraged. They've almost got no leverage at all. So they've got literally 5 million of net debt. So it's quite a lot of it is, the majority is freehold.
Yeah.
And they've got a little bit of net debt. So that affords them opportunity in this kind of market. So they've just bought a couple of pubs for bargain basement prices. One of them just near the bridge in Barnes in London really low valuations. But this is the kind of CEOs we like investing in. When I'm discussing with him, well, there must be loads of opportunities. He's going, yes, but we're so undervalued that they've got to stack up. They've got to be Mate, so he's actually doing a buyback as well. So he's buying back shares and he's selectively buying, adding to the group. The third piece, which should happen relatively shortly, is that they've got an associate investment in a chain, well, not chain, but another pub group of about 11 pubs.
Mm.
And they've got about 38% of it. They've signaled that they're going to go to majority of control. We'd expect them to do that at a very sensible valuation and then essentially add 10 to 12 units to the group, which has 44. That make a lot of sense for shareholders, we suspect. So low down, and the when you said at the start, that's not quite the thing. So it's, let's say, low margins, sentiment poor, very, very cheap. Great management, good business. So that's why we're interested in that.
And I guess a similar sort of thing is for Galliford Try, because I know it's run by a guy, is it Bill Hocking or something like
that? That's right.
He's got a great reputation, hasn't he? And I know that contracting has been a tough industry, but is the thesis on valuation and management turnaround there as well?
Exactly. So you can't stress enough how, you know, if you get 10 fund managers in a room, 9 of them will say they never invest in contracting or construction.
It's had a lot of blow ups. I can understand a lot of minds.
Yeah, Carillion, Molem. It's a total graveyard. So
yeah.
I'm not surprised. But the thing is, things do evolve. And what's happened as a result of that is that the kind of survivors or who's left have been under huge pressure from both their shareholders and the boards to reduce the risk in generalized contracting and improve the what's caused a lot of these. And if you try and disaggregate, it was really either problem contracts that get completely out of control and blow up the P&L, or over M&A, which was sort of the Carillion case. So Galliford isn't doing any serious M&A like that. And it also has its average jobs are much, much smaller. So its average job size is not that much over £20 million. And it's public sector. So it's Galliford does, obviously, literally prisons, schools, hospitals, highways, water, you know, national grids,
rail. Yeah,
I mean, it's, you know, if we can be cautious about the world or Britain, I think those things are all we're going to be spending money on. And the valuation is completely nuts. I mean, it's literally completely nuts. So the market cap's about
110, and it's
it's more than that. I think it's 190 now.
Oh, sorry, it is, yes. That's the right number of shares. Yeah. 190, you're right.
It's 190, which conveniently is about, in the last time they checked the cash in the bank spot, it was 195 million of cash.
Yeah.
Now, that's a bit, they know that's a bit of a nonsense, because the average level of cash is about 165 million. And in that, there are also, when you really get into the detail of it, there's a sort of net payments they've received in advance, things like that. However, the average is 165. So that's a good starting point when we're thinking about what the risks are with the business. They also have a cheeky little portfolio of PPP, former PFI assets, worth 48 million quid.
Mm.
Director's valuation. Half of that we found out is a particular scheme that Balfour Beatty had in their PFI portfolio and sold about 2 years ago for a higher valuation than what they're holding it in their 48 million. So they've got, now they've also got, finally, they've got some claims out which they've had to flag because they think they're in quite a strong position. They also got claims out for £95 million that they may negotiate and receive money back from. I have that as sort of option value, but let's just wait to see the news on that. The business itself has 3.5 billion of order book.
Yeah.
So no shortage of work. And as you've said at the start, Bill Hocking is already proving he's doing a very good job in improving the divisional margins. And they're targeting 3% and a decent top line growth rate. What's slightly weird about the business is that it, in the world of construction and big construction, it still is actually quite small.
Mm.
So I think that particularly relative to kind of its corporate overhead and all the rest of it. So it wouldn't surprise me if they there's some people are thinking about Galliford in the bigger scheme of things in terms of exposure to UK regulated and infrastructure spend.
Yeah, No, it does definitely look significantly undervalued. Another one is Finsbury Food, which does all things sort of like celebration cakes and croissants and sort of artisanal breads and stuff like that to the supermarkets. And presumably does it to the food service sector as well. I think the margins are roughly, they're quite low actually, about sort of 4-5%, et cetera. Is it sort of like an opportunity, a bit of self-help here?
Yeah, so you got the business right. Yeah, the H1 margins actually hit 3.4%.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but the average...
I've been generous.
Yeah, a bit generous at the moment. But the average over the years has been about 5, just over about 5.
Yeah, okay.
They're targeting... Now, the management team here are absolutely first rate. Again, they've been around... They've been running Finsbury brilliantly. They came in not long after the GFC and have essentially completely sorted it out. They've done some very sensible acquisitions that haven't destroyed shareholder value over the years. They did a fantastic one literally the other day called Lee's Food, where they now, which is, you will believe, it's meringues and snowballs. I had to find out what a snowball was.
Oh, I used to, yeah, they're lovely. Those are snowballs.
I know what meringue is, but the business they bought has 75% market share of meringues in the UK. I mean,
wow. So
they're very carefully just adding things into
niche stuff where they've got really strong position.
Yeah, their best position, as you say, is in celebration cakes. So if anyone's been to any watching that's been to any children's party or grandchildren's party, and it's Marvel or Disney, The Simpsons. Literally, they have all the Mary Berry. They do, and they basically anything branded, they're the market leader by some margin. The company has been investing heavily in things like ERP and stuff. Successfully, though, in the last few years, and I think they were about to do what magicians call the big reveal. I think they're about to go into a kind of breakout margin story. But then they've had this massive problem with cost inflation in the last 15 months, which is why the margins are where they are. And that has hit, that's, we think, obscured a material improvement in the underlying efficiency and productivity of Finsbury Foods, which once things sort of calm down in the food world, we think probably will re-emerge. The other aspect of it, which is relevant, is that they are also very under-geared. So about 0.8, 0.9 times net.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah.
They've got huge facilities because it's a very cash generative, very steady business in terms of their sales, sell all to the main multiples, very good market share. It's likely that they could do quite a lot more M&A. And we talked about sort of takeovers and things like that. One could see this as being run much more aggressively if it was in private equity hands than what public markets would allow it to do to leverage itself up. I mean, there are sometimes they got themselves in a real pickle at this sector by over leveraging, but they're definitely under leveraged. So we noted that another fund manager, it's actually happened after we bought our initial shares, called DBay.
They've got a track record of buying things out.
They've built a 13% stake since we bought our stock. We're not sure quite what they are up to, but we saw that as validation that this is a because they do know what they're doing. DBay.
Yeah, they do.
This is a undervalued and relatively low risk equity. Again, just thinking our mindset again. We're 3 years. What could happen in 3 years? Could we double our money? What's the target profitability? What's the target rating? And then taking our time. I went down to Cardiff where they make the celebration cakes.
I bet the smell was great.
It's very sugary. It's very
okay, sugary. Is it okay?
They do all the kind of the caterpillars.
So okay,
Pollen. They weren't embroiled in that, but they do everyone else's caterpillars that sort of look a bit like Pollen the caterpillar.
Yeah, okay.
It's a very well run business with very very good management. So
brilliant. Okay, now just moving on to Argentex, the foreign exchange dealer and also sort of international payments platform. A big congrats and a thanks, actually, because when we spoke in September, you sort of pointed this one out at 80p, and I thought, she looks pretty interesting. So I bought a sort of half a position. That was the last time I chanced to get over buy it. But anyway, so it's gone from about 80p to about 130. But actually, the underlying business has almost motored even faster. I think sales are growing at good, strong double digits. digits, and they seem to be hitting on all cylinders in terms of international expansion and technology. Do you want to take us through your latest thoughts on this one?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It still continues to grow. I think they're due to do about 50 million for the year just sort of finished.
Yeah.
And then up to 60 million of turnover the following year.
That's correct, yeah.
I think at this point I'd touch on that the market leader, which is owned by sort of bigger small cap managers, or the one that they all think is amazing, it's called Alpha. It used to be called Alpha FX, but they've
yes, that's right.
tweaked the name. That's got 120 million of sales, what a forecast I have, so about twice the size of the business. But Kelsey Priest, that's being valued at 700 million.
Yes.
So our Gentex is 150 million with half the sales. It's so much, much, much cheaper. The differences between the two, I think the Alpha guys, other than just being bigger and hitting their numbers since IPO, were sort of did invest well into tech from the off. Our Gentex have always invested in tech, but I think we would, our assessment would be that they were a bit behind, maybe not investing as much as they probably needed to, and they've now addressed that. They hired a very, very impressive and experienced individual called David Christie to be their head of tech and COO. He's really sorting that out, which is giving them the tools and the products that they can sell. It was really a lack of products enabled by tech that the guys could grow. They also are going into, they've gone into the Netherlands and they're awaiting their license in Australia. I suspect both of those will be profitable geographies relatively quickly. And I think the other management change that was happening about the time that we spoke last was the new finance director had come in. And as I said, they've been missing numbers and everyone hates that. Mm. So they've been missing numbers, but still very profitable. So she sort of did a massive sort of slash and burn of expectations, which leaves us in a very interesting position on the day of this a podcast, Paul, because, you know, if you look at market numbers for our Gentex, they still look very conservative to me. Mm. And I think that if you look at Alpha's operating margins and also our Gentex's historic operating margins, which are probably a bit over earning because not enough in tech, but there's quite a lot of upside to where they are. And they've already now put in a 2 or 3 upgrades since she's recut the numbers. I'm optimistic that there'll be more upgrades coming through with the next announcement. That would be our expectation.
It's a good inflation hedge as well, isn't it? Because it's a percentage commission of the actual underlying value of the transaction that the client does. So effectively, as inflation hits out, and you know, particularly in sort of like their non fund manager asset management business and just the normal sort of like, you know, industrials, etc., then it should track inflation.
I think that is true. I think also though, the big picture with them is just how bad the banks are.
Yes, you're right.
And they're
still
just really small. And as more people find out about them or more people get comfortable about outsourcing their FX to an Alpha or an Argentes, I think that will be quite a dominant thing. They could be, you know, multiples of the current size and still be very small for various. So it is it is a proper, old school Wall Street style, ringing people up, getting onto the treasurer and saying, you know, we can both give you better service and do you better rates than you're getting from your mainstream bank, and then getting the treasurer to do something about it. So,
Well, it certainly seems to be working well. In fact, I think your in price is up. Must be up over 50% since you bought in. So that's pretty good going. Or more,
100%.
Okay. Well, that's not so bad. That's probably why your portfolio has done so well. Now, one which hasn't been quite so, and apologies for the pun, smooth, is Smooth in the fact that it's obviously one of these digital real estate. Well, basically, I think it does it's sort of like conveyancing and software to help effectively the likes of Lloyds do their transactions, and it also does it with the with mortgages and all the financial services. It becomes a one-stop shop for helping people do all of that sort of like, you know, transaction. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it's sort of obviously the housing market's gone south since, you bought like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, it hasn't been working out as planned, this thesis, particularly from the point at which I purchased it, which was a while ago, actually, now. It was actually my first shares I actually bought in this were the day before the general election of where Boris won the election.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you've been very patient then.
Yeah. But at that point, the plan had been that they were investing in a product called Digital Move, where they'd sort of calibrated how much they were going to spend pretty much. But then once that had gone in about a couple of years, it was going to be sort of plain sailing, loads of, and then sort of everything else, sales from them would be, drop through to profitability. And it was sort of trying to create a bit of a platform from their software business that is a bit of a, essentially a marketplace between conveyancers,
yes,
the lawyer conveyancers, and those that need a mortgage transaction, a housing transaction completed. And the latest stats are pretty, I mean, this is a problem they need solving. It's on average, it takes 154 days now to finish a housing transaction. So their idea was that they could like speed it up, and everyone's a winner, from the lawyer who gets his fee quicker for just the same amount of work, to the consumer that's less stressed and can get crack on with their life, to the estate agent who can clip his commission and get down to the pub as they do. What's happened though is that there was a managerial change there. Jesper with Frogstruck has come in, and they were. It seems that the system itself, the core system itself, was a bit underdeveloped. Well, they were trying to add something new to it. They kind of needed to do more overall. So he's brought in quite a higher cost team of very high quality people to try and really get the tech going there. That's meant that the kind of roadmap to making profits, which is what Rockwood focuses on, has been extended, and is currently still expected to be 2 to 3 years away.
Wow, okay.
Which we're not particularly happy about, to be frank. What it is now is the market cap is about 19 million, and they have roughly about 20 million of sales. Although, as you should say, marketplace and housing now, near-term trading is probably quite difficult for them. Mortgage approvals obviously down, and it's difficult. So it's not going to be an easy environment for them. But about 20 million of sales. Now, they did have over 20 million of cash. We actually engaged with the company to get them to return some of the cash. We felt they had too much cash and they didn't need it all. And they did. We did tender some of our stock in the last tender just recently to reduce our position. But in aggregate, it's still going to have about 9 million roughly of cash. So you're sort of on about half sales, which is cheap for a software business. What's the level of investment there that's going on, if we think that 20 million, if they weren't sort of trying the new products they're trying to develop, I'll tell you about this in a second very quickly, but they probably make about 4 million of EBITDA.
Yeah.
So, but the current forecast, which may be right, may be wrong, that the market has now, is that they, if the new products are successful, they'll be making 4 million of EBITDA in 3 years' time. So we're sort of quite engaged with them about what the right way forward here is, and the risks around them. Now, the two products they've come up with, one is essentially it's for estate agents to get embed themselves with estate agents to get them into their product to help them speed up these transactions, and that I always get them mixed slightly the right way. I think that's called Smooth Start. It's called Smooth Start. And then they also have, they develop a thing called Smooth Complete, which is actually which is a product that people that don't work for big legal firms and want to go out on their own as consultant conveyancers can use to take all the admin away. It sort of does all the faff for them. Now, because both of them are quite nicely modeled, in as much as that if they are successful, they will generate decent profits for them. And they still have very low market share, the business. It's still one of the biggest players in this space, but their best guess is about just over 2% of UK housing transactions end up using Smooth. So we are monitoring it. Now, all said apart, there is a huge amount of people invested in and trying to develop business models in this whole prop fintech.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Okay. So, and it may be that some of them are looking at what Smooth is doing, looking at its runway for cash generation or whatever. It might actually be exactly the kind of thing that they're after. So we'll just be watching this pretty carefully. And we'd like them to make sure that they, you know, they recalibrate the investment to cut the clock for according, you know,
accelerate that path to profitability would make an absolute sea change to the share price. That's for sure.
I think when you get a thesis, or the thesis is kind of broken, your original thesis is broken, you know, you can you have to be very, very careful about, you know, making the right decision and saying, like, you know, saying I've got it wrong, so I'm just selling, moving on, recycling capital. Or can you evolve the thesis or see it and make sure you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. So I think even with their proposed cash investment, there's still going to be more than sufficient cash actually for some time. So, and the valuation is on its knees. So we are, you know, we wish them the best of luck. We literally hope that they, you know, are going to deliver. So we're not selling anything at all at the moment. We, as I said, just reduce the position a bit with tendering, and we're hoping they can build that profitability back. But they absolutely have to do that, and it's probably the only thing we've got which now looks a lot like, well, some small cap fund managers' portfolios must have lots of these sorts of things, which were, you know, investing heavily in growth, and now it feels like a bit more of a not the right cycle for that.
Yeah, well, you can't do every single one, can you? Sort of like be perfect, and also some of the stocks, they just have different sinks, and if their returns happen further to the right, then that's just the way it plays. You can't, everything doesn't sort of like, you know, mature or blossom at the same sort of time. What is the sort of hit rate for Rockwood? I mean, mine is sort of, I mean, I go small caps. It's sort of like two in every three work, but a third sort of like go south. I'm guessing, given what you've just said, it is actually a bit higher than mine, a lot higher.
It's a very difficult question to answer because
timescales.
Because we don't do lots of investments, and a number of them have been in the last 3 years. So we're sort of finished. The early ones are sort of maturing now. I almost want you to just ask me that in literally about 3 years' time. I'll give you a sort of
okay.
More,
I'll ask you in 3 years' time
for people listening. I would say the better way of looking at that, just look at the returns in the fund. We're happy. We're very happy with those. Yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, if you set yourself a bar of 15% per annum and you beat that, then you're doing pretty well. Now, another one we've chatted on last time back in September was M&C Saatchi, which I think at that time it was under a sort of a bid offer, was trying to be taken over by Vin Murray's. And I think that's now died its death, and it's sort of operating. It's basically a traditional advertising business.
Yes, yes. So they managed to, and we rejected as well, bids from Vin Murray. Who still has a large shareholding in it, and also Next 15.
Got
stuck in as well. They both of them had realised that this business was massively undervalued by the stock market and were up for trying to exploit that for their own benefit. But both the management and shareholders realised that what we own. It's fair to say those were quite opportunistic approaches, because the company had been an absolute mess with an accounting scandal, accounting scandal, poor finances, and got itself into a mess with its M&A structure, with how it buys out its people it had supported to open up new offices around the world, because it is a global business and one of the best known brands in advertising. Let's face it. And as a result, they'd had quite a long period of no kind of marketing or talking to the city really about what they do and, you know, how the business has been developing. And what it is, a lot of people just think it's still creative, you know, creative advertiser doing, billboards to, you know, beat the Labour Party up or whatever.
Thought they were doing.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's got a number of divisions. Their best, the division I enjoy the most, they call Passions, which is where they do, it's all to do with sport and music and those sorts of things, where they do, for instance, they have the Barclays contract for the Premiership. They do Coca-Cola for the Olympics. They and a range of other kind of passions and interesting things like that. They have another huge piece which is about where they advise on comms and on comms for governments and other types of organizations like that. Very non-cyclical, steady stuff. They actually worked on the Biden campaign, for instance. They work for the British government, the UN, the World Health Organization, the Australian government, those sorts of things. And they're the market leader by some margin in that activity. They do still have the creative business, and there was a sort of view that that was sort of in decline or not very, a bit old school. But actually, that's sort of morphed over the years, and they've got huge, clients like TikTok and McDonald's, and decent set of clients. They also have a tech-enabled performance marketing division, which is the type of thing, roughly, by the way, if anyone's an expert, is roughly the sort of thing that Martin Sorrell was sort of focusing entirely on with his S4 thing. They've got their own version of that, which is well. So very good business. And they've come out. I went to the CMD at their Golden Square offices in Soho the other day, and to meet so high quality the divisional directors and the next layer down. So proper people business with great people. That they came out with big targets in the next few years. So they are now expecting to grow at 8% CAGR, the top line, and they're targeting 18% margins.
Is that going to be achievable, though, in this environment? Because advertising is tough as old boots at the moment.
Yeah, so the market leaders make 18, and most of them make sort of between 13 and 16% margins. So it's just, it's going to be a push. It's definitely not a kind of shy target, but the market's skeptical, doesn't think they will at all. I mean, it's on 0.9 of sales, I think. If you use that as a sort of rule of thumb, it's the market saying you're not going to get better than 9% margins. Well, they're going to be doing 13.5 right now. So yeah, okay. They already have been growing those margins. So I think high 16-17% margins. And why? The tech business is high margin, like 20s type margins. The it's really the creative bit, which is more about 10-11, which they think they can get to 13 in that mix to get up to 18 or 19. It's also got cash, net cash at the moment. Some of that still needs to go out to pay out some of the minorities, which that means they will earn all of the cash flows from those businesses. But when you run through, it came up in the CMD and they confirmed it in the CMD, so it's public information. But if they achieve their targets and all the way through, by 2027, they think the company will have 195 million of net cash.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. So what's likely though is they don't, because we think they're going to buy. They're going to start doing some bolt-ons, and also they'll definitely come back onto the. They've signaled it already. They're definitely going to back onto the dividend list. So we think some decent dividends coming out as well. I wouldn't rule out people coming back. Not now, but in the next 3 years, I bet you if they continue improving the margins, that people come back and offer a proper price for the business. We're targeting conservatively at least 300p a share, but you could make a case for a much higher than that. But that's where we started buying after they came out of suspension. So I think my earliest price was like 55p, but I think we averaged about 80p share or something.
Oh, well done. Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, it seems to have plenty of upside, especially given that sort of potential growth and self-help, but also you've got that put underneath the shares with potential M&A, somebody buying it if they do ever, have a slip or it gets tough with sort of consolidation. Now, just one on the sort of industrials. We've had a couple, sort of like Flowtech, Fluid Power and Pressure Tech. If you just quickly go through those, because, again, I know I chatted to you about 2 years ago, and I think these are sort of, you've been very patient on them, good management teams, but it's been a tough old slog, I think, certainly on the fluid power in terms of sort of like pneumatics and hydraulics sort of parts and services in the UK as a distributor. And likewise with Pressure Tech, that two divisions, one being the oil and gas, which should be coming back now, and the large cylinders for hydrogen and for the defence side.
Yeah, so let's do Pressure Technologies first. They had a real struggle with both managing their quite lumpy contracts that they have in the defense industry. And but the good news is that whilst the lumpiness will continue, they've literally in the last 6 weeks announced they've won. They didn't disclose the who the client was, but you could sort of interpret that it will have been the latest, the last two of the nuclear submarines on the Dreadnought program. They did. They said it was about 18 million's worth of sales, probably at least 2 years, maybe 2.5 years of revenues out of that. Sales in that division are about, I think, 17, 18 million pounds. So it's a kind of seriously big order. But they have they've struggled with the lumpiness of that, some of which isn't really their fault. So just on the with the new accounting laws on revenue recognition, if the steel to make the stuff hasn't landed in the UK, they're not allowed to book the revenues. And as you know, it's just, you know, they've been pretty unlucky with some of the time. The timing of those was very near their year ends and that sort of thing. But that business, Chesterfield, is an absolute cracker. It's been about been around for over 120 years. It's got a massive freehold site, 120,000 square foot, just off the M1 in Sheffield too. And they have also been building an interesting line in hydrogen-related cylinders, which is a very early stage growth market, but it looks like they are going to feature in it. And I think that'll be there for many years to come. They're also, and they haven't talked much about this, but they've also do what they call integrity management systems, and it, which is testing. And you might remember there's been a number of testers on the UK stock market, all of which have been taken out. They're very high quality businesses. And for instance, they'll have a line of where they go and do the test and servicing and like warranties on other people's cylinders. So they could build that over the next few years as well. The big problem also has been that the previous management team built out a division called PMC, stands for Precision Machine Components, which is a kind of advanced manufacturing business. Down to two sites, but was very focused on the oil and gas industry, which for the last few years has been an absolute nightmare for them. Even more nightmare in that they have quite a significant customer concentration on the oil and gas side. They're the good people. It's like Baker Hughes, Schlumberger, Cameron, Halliburton, these sort of guys they make the kit for. But those guys, particularly in their kind of European sort of operations, haven't been that active. Interestingly, now the cycle is actually changing as a result of Ukraine and people wanting to develop and the oil price general environment. So if you look at the Baker Hughes rig count, or indeed these commentary from most of these players, the cycles now, and they're very long cycles, these oil cycles. So it's coming up. So that we expect the sales in that division to be materially improving. Now, we engaged with the company a lot in the last 18 months. And they have actually announced that they are now seeking to find an outcome for the PMC division. So the cycle's in good play. It's a good business, good clients. We'll see what value we come out. I'd rather not say what we think it could be worth.
I know. Yeah, I mean, you've had a lot of expertise when we happened similar with Kreschik, didn't you? With their
Now this is interesting, Paul, because you've sort of got the case. This is sort of thing. So that business, I think market expectations are for them to have about 10 million of sales this year.
Yeah.
So just give you a sense of that. So if they are successful in finding buyers, or in fact more than one buyer, and they end up with a decent price, then that will then go. Then you've just got the Chesterfield business. It might make sense at that point to change the name. You might see the playbook here, Paul. And then and then if you remember with Kreschik, one of the key things we did was we supported the business when it sold the Tasman division to reinvest the money into expanding the factory, which allowed them to bring forward a lot of the order book and generate even more EBITDA than everyone expected. That's gross simplification, but should we just say
analogy to the rental bit part of the load bank business for Kreschik is your services business in your cylinders, I guess, your testing.
So Chesterfield is, you know, we'll and they've and the CEO there has made some deep, very distant hires. It's fair to say he needed a CEO that came into place during last year, and there's a new finance director arriving at Pressure Tech, literally imminently in the next few weeks, actually. So we'd see that as a relatively simple way of generating shareholder value again, probably over the next couple of years. That sort of 2-3 years max.
Well, if you go from 40p to £4, then you won't do too badly, which is the same as Christchurch.
You never know. There's definitely a decent upside. We've got 20%. We own 20% of Pressure Tech. We've got 20% of Pressure Tech. We had 26% of Christchurch. So
you're aligned. Anyway, so just finally then on Flowtech Fluid Power, because this one has had obviously, you know, it's got quite niche positions with sort of like hydraulics and pneumatics distribution in the UK, and it's headed up by Roger McDowell as well, and I think the management team's very good. But again, they've sort of like, it's been a number of headwinds, hasn't it, over the last 2 or 3 years?
Yes. So the business is going to do about 7.5% margins, roughly.
That's right. Yeah, 8%. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They should be doing 11. Yeah. Okay. And that's important when you look at the EBITDA multiples for the business, because if they were doing 11, you could think what the EBITDA might be. They also their stock turn is miles away from their stated target for their stock turn. So distribution businesses, I've always said, it's just relatively simple what they need to be good at. They need to be really focused on return of capital. The capital is typically the stock. So they need to just do that as fast as possible, and then you get the highest returns because you get to replace it and charge the margin as many times as you can. So that, and the second thing is the service, so that people want you to use you for their distribution. And if you get those two things right, you'll make really good money as a distributor. The service bit for them and the industry has been moving from super large, you know, yellow pages style catalogs to online and digital delivery for those. And it's fair to say they've been quite slow at getting that up and running. And they kind of got their first version of what they want kind of last year. Although I suspect that needs quite a lot of work to get up to what they really need to be doing to really be humming in terms of digital. And some of the clients may still really love the catalog. So it's fair to say there is a bit of a process with in the fluid power industry of getting everyone on the same wavelength. Those opportunities are there now. You mentioned Roger McDowell. One of his first businesses that he was an executive in rather than a board member in was actually a distribution business. So he really understands distribution. We know him well because we had Orgean, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember. You had another home run there, didn't you?
We did. Yeah. So we know he understands shareholder value. He's a very good chairman, and he'll make the right decisions for us to make sure everyone gets the right kind of returns from the stock. But equally, also during last year, not as our representative, but he is on the Rockwood Investment Advisory Group, Jamie Brooke. Joined the board of Flowtech Fluid Power. He's been a fund manager for over 30 years and done a lot of strategic investing. He was a short period at Hanover, but a longer period at Lombard Odier, and then Gartmore, Janus Henderson. And he's also gone on the board. The business has its stock got a bit too high. Again, you want the least amount of stock for the right level of service, and then to spin it a lot. And it has been a relatively tricky environment because of global supply chains from having the right amount of stock. But that should start to come down, and then they should start to be able to speed it up and then make sure they're charging the right margin. So when you work through all of that, you could, let's say it gets to 11% margins, maybe it would justify at least 1.1 times sales. I think sales in the next current year are going to be 120 million.
Yeah.
So maybe, you get to 130 million. If they didn't do any acquisitions, we'll get onto that in a moment. If they didn't do any acquisitions, it might be even debt free by the time they're making 10-11% margins. So market cap at 75, 130, 140 million of target EV. We make 8% from here, something like that, if everything works according to plan. The acquisition piece is that it's a very interesting industry where there are a number still of smaller fluid power guys doing roughly the same thing, which they could potentially also continue to acquire. They were acquisitive before, and they've slowed that massively down. And accretive things they could do. Equally, there are much bigger players in distribution that could see fluid power as maybe a more like just another product suite alongside their other ones, and it could be hugely attractive to external buyers. So, but it is a solid, even, you know, as you can see, even in the current conditions, it's a, you know, profitable business without a stressed balance sheet. It's just, we think there could be much better operational performance, and we're engaged with that with the company.
Yeah. And when does the sort of Rockwell ever decide to sell? Because you're extremely patient, and you actually, when things don't go quite your way, you're obviously very proactive in putting people on the board and trying to make sure that it does move in the right direction to hit the thesis. But at what stage do you get sort of like, okay, I can't do much more than this, and you decide to, it comes down to valuation, or is it just some?
Yeah, so if you remember, the things what we're doing, trying to do, we're trying to double our money in 3 to 5 years. If it takes 5 years, you get, because of the compound, we get 15% a year.
Yeah.
And I'm obviously targeting 3, really, so that'll make up for the ones we get wrong. We might add sort of thing. So you're trying to double. And how we double is we look at what can the profitability get to in that 3 to 5 year period, and then what would be the multiple or the right valuation for that business if it was to achieve that level of profitability. And then we buy, then we engage, and we make sure that everyone is on the same, singing the same hymn in order to get to that point. So the natural point to sell when everything's worked out is when they're achieving that level of profitability, and then the valuation is appropriate. Now, if the market valuation has got to our target valuation, we would just sell into the market if there is secondary demand. That would happen in the minority of cases, maybe 30 to 40% of outcomes. In 60 to 70% of outcomes, you get to that point, and maybe because, sadly, as you see all the time, for Britain, but not sadly for investors like us, you know, the stock market's pretty broken and won't value it properly, and it requires a trade buyer or a public private to take us out. We do evolve though, so you do have your thesis, but maybe let's say you're at year 2 and then you work out, well, actually the profitability is going to be X, or it might even be more, or you can go, well, I can double my money, I've gone up 50%, but actually now I can double money from here, from this new 3 to 5 year series. So we will evolve like that. When it's gone wrong, it's a bit like we were discussing earlier. You have to decide, is it, actually, I know the way, I've just had an idea. This is how to explain it. You know Quality Street? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know Quality Street? There's two of the Quality Streets have been withdrawn over the years.
Now, nobody used to like the toffee, did they?
No, wait, that's still in there. The peanut cracknell's gone. They took that out. And if you're a bit older listeners will know that the gooseberry cream was also pulled a number of years.
Okay, right, yeah.
Now, what you need to do when you're evaluating things is you should go, is this, you know, a gooseberry cream or peanut cracknell? And basically no one wants to eat them or be interested, in which case you need to find some sort of solution, salvage what capital you can, but most important is to recycle it into a good idea as quickly as possible. Or you need to decide, actually, is it just one of the purple ones, which are the most popular ones in Quality Street? And basically just realize that someone drops it out of the tin, or it's covered up by the toffee one, and it's worth just fighting for.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Richard. If somebody wants to invest in the Rockwood Fund, the Rockwood Strategic Fund, how best to do that? Obviously, you're listed, aren't you? So I'm guessing it's fairly straightforward.
Yeah, so late last year, we moved from AIM to the main market, premium listings, full corporate governance. So you can buy us, the tickers, RKW.
Yeah.
We'd love you to love people to join us for what we trying to compound wealth long term. That's simply the plan. Well, our website's got loads of information about how we go about it, our philosophy, our process in more detail than we've discussed today, our fact sheets, our latest presentation, and that's www.rockwoodstrategic.co.uk. there's contact details on there if people want to have a further conversation with me or the team.
Brilliant. Well, I'm absolutely fascinated to learn what those eight stocks are that you talked about at the start, the due diligence and how you're going to deploy.
I promise you another interview, probably early summer, to give you a few new ones.
Okay, yeah. Great. Well, as I say, there'll be plenty to have a good sift through. So thanks very much, Richard, and speak to you in about 6 months' time.
Great to see you, Paul. Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.